Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast, listener. We're back. Welcome back to Claire. It's been much missed.
Have I?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
So we have had a bit of a break. What have we been up to, guys? Anything we want to share with the listener?
I went on a cruise for less than 48 hours around the Solent as a COVID procedures testing thing for the Disney Cruise Line. So I got to test out all of their COVID procedures, so like how would it work running a cruise in a socially distanced way. It's every bit as surreal and strange as you would imagine. Basically a Disney theme park at sea. So no, it's good fun.
Am I correct in thinking that there were characters on this cruise?
Yeah, there were.
What kind of characters? Who was there?
Oh, you know, all the big hitters. Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, all the princesses. Like, obviously, you can't go up and hug them. So if you wanted your picture taken with a Disney princess, they're all stood on one floor. You have to sort of angle your camera, like get a selfie. Like, oh, we're down. So that was a bit different.
So it was okay for them to sort of like breathe a cloud over the audience, but the audience were on a tier below so that, you know, like you can't reach them with your droplets.
Oh, God. Yeah, now I think about it. Yeah, that's a really bad idea. I'll put that in my feedback form. It was good fun. Yeah, just thrill. I haven't really been anywhere in the whole of lockdown. So suddenly going from nowhere to suddenly like, this is a bit much, like in terms of sensory overload.
It does sound utterly surreal. Sounds a lot of fun though. Mm-hmm. Was there a consequence to this?
Yes, but I'd just like to say it has nothing to do with like probably the cruise itself. But yeah, I did end up having to self-isolate afterwards. Not because I had corona, but that's what I had potentially at some point, I think, probably from when the exposure notification said, probably when I was in the ferry terminal on my way out. So I ended up self-isolating for 10 days after. So that's another reason I'm just not really going out anymore, because it sort of seems a bit like you can have one day of fun and then have to go under house arrest again for 10 days. So I'd rather just stay at home. And
yeah, you have to pay for your pleasure, don't you?
Yeah, more so than usual. So yeah, I'm just going to stay home. Carry on protecting the NHS and saving lives like the absolute champ that I am.
Yeah, you are a hero. I also got pinged after attending a much less fun event, kind of educational event, shall we say. I was sitting in a session about Alan Turing, which I think is when I got the ping, or the beginning trigger for the ping. So thanks, Alan, for that. But I got 6 days. I think, Caroline, you got a longer stretch.
Oddly, even though I went away with like my family, they all had to self-isolate as well, but I got an extra day. I think NHS track and trace just really didn't want me back on the streets for a while, so they gave me an extra day than everybody else.
Claire, you've escaped the pandemic.
So far. It's worrying how many people have said, oh, I'm just going to delete that app because then I can't be pinged. You know, yeah. Like that's not really how, you know, it's just ignorance of ping that way. Doesn't mean that you weren't exposed to anything.
They can still get you though. You've got like the manual trace people out on, yeah. Like,
they're gonna find you.
Yeah, they can actually come to your house and like knock on your door and say, you need to self-isolate, stay here. Like, oh, okay.
They have a very specific set of skills.
They will find you.
And they will ping you.
Yeah. I wonder if that's what Liam Neeson's up to these days. But yeah, he does sound like the kind of person they would need. Mm. But yeah, that is worrying, the thing about people deleting the app seems a bit stupid, but also it's very logical. Like, while infection rates are going up, you are going to get more people pinged because there's more people just wandering around in the population with COVID. So
absolutely, yeah.
Just mass people.
Yeah, and I feel for the people that feel like that's their only option as well. You know, like for example, if someone says, if you have to self-isolate, you're not going to get paid.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, I'll just delete that app then, because then I can't be pinged, which means that I won't have to stay at home and not go to a shift or whatever.
Yeah, that's a really good point though.
Yeah, there should be more financial support people don't have to feel like they have to risk their health at risk
and other people's.
Yeah
It's all very well for us who are working from home anyway. It wasn't a massive inconvenience, I have to say, and it is, I guess it's playing some sort of role in controlling the virus as well. I mean, that is working the way it was supposed to work. Suck up the time, especially if, like us, you can work from home quite blithely. Should we get on with the show?
Yeah,
yes,
sure. So, just to say where we're going, as usual in the episode, Caroline, you've got a hot news story about tax.
As always, All my stories on tax are very, very exciting. Yeah, this is just, I guess, some updates on the fallout from the IR35 reforms coming that were introduced in the public sector back in April 2017. So, you know, what's going on there now?
And Claire, it's that time of the year again.
Feels like it's always that time of year. But yeah, it is our annual list of the top 50 women in UK tech. The shortlist has just been released and the voting is open. So.
The voting has begun. I'm going to talk about company cultures. Should we have them or not? The jumping off point for that is an interview with the co-CEO of Workday, a gentleman called Chano Fernandez. But more on that towards the end of the podcast. So we're starting with Caroline on a big fine for a big government department.
Well, I think we have to be careful in the terminology in this. It's not a fine, it's a tax bill. Yeah, okay. So just so we're clear. But yeah, so if you're an IT contractor or someone who's involved in the hiring of contractors, you'll probably be familiar with the concept of IR35. And if you're not either of those things and you don't know anything about IR35, lucky you, is all I'll say. It's a piece of 20-year-old tax legislation that the government introduced to try and clamp down on tax avoidance within the self-employed and freelance community. And for most of the time it's been in place, the legislation has put the onus on contractors to decide for themselves if the work they do and how it's performed means they should be taxed off-payroll worker, so outside IR35, or if they should be taxed in the same way that a permanent employee would be, which would make them inside IR35. And that means, you know, they pay income tax, they pay national insurance contributions and things like that, but they don't get any benefits, like workplace benefits, like a permanent employee would. And that's how it used to work up until 2017, when HMRC tweaked the rules so that in the public sector, if you were a public sector organisation, so a government department or something like that, and you hire contractors, you became responsible for deciding how they should be taxed. So no longer would the contractors say, I need to be taxed this way or taxed that way. The people who hire them started making those decisions from 2017 onwards. And as you can probably gather, that placed quite a big administrative burden on sort of public sector organisations, who suddenly found themselves having to individually assess the tax status of potentially hundreds of contractors ahead of this sort of April 2017 deadline. And to help them out with that, HMRC sort of provided this free online tool called CEST, which stands for Check Employment Status for Tax, a very, very catchy name. And it sort of uses like multiple choice questions to help public sector organisations work out, you know, this contractor works this way, you know, should they be taxed this way or that way? So it's, you know, you put in inputs and you get an output. That's pretty much how it works. So the public sector have had a few years now to try and get used to the changes, but details have started to emerge now. But the implementation of these changes in the public sector, well, I haven't been smooth sailing at all for these organisations. So I don't know if anyone listening to the podcast or any of the reporting I did for Computer Weekly sort of around the time these changes were being introduced back in 2017. The fact that things haven't gone particularly smoothly probably doesn't come as much of a surprise. You know, at the time, we had stories about IT contractors walking out of projects because they disagreed with how their, say, government department or, you know, a public sector organisation that they work for had, you know, assessed their tax status. And also we had things like hearing reports of, say, HR managers getting so flustered with these changes that they just decided, you know what, we don't have time to individually assess every single contractor. So what we're going to do is we'll just declare everyone's inside R35 and get on with our lives and things like that. And that obviously upset a lot of IT contractors because they didn't want to be declared inside R35. So anyway, that was 2017. This is 2021. And in the interim, there's been a fair few public sector organisations, it turns out, that have had their IR35 compliance procedures placed under review by HMRC. And the results are in and they're not very good. So the Department for Work and Pensions have been hit with a tax bill totaling £87.9 million for historic inaccuracies when they've been assessing the tax status of their contractors. And then yesterday, I wrote a story about the Home Office getting accused of being careless in its implementation of the IR35 rules. And it had got a tax bill for £29.5 million. And it had to pay, well, it also got hit with a further £4 million penalty for being careless with how it was implementing IR35 as well. So, but that penalty is suspended for the time being. So it looks like at the moment, these reports are coming in dribs and drabs about public sector organisations and their tax bills for IR35 related stuff. But I think, you know, we've had two in quite quick succession, and I reckon there'll be loads more to come over the next couple of months. You know, as these organisations, they all have to compile company reports and accounts and stuff like that. So there'll probably be details in there about how much the IR35 reforms have cost them as well. Obviously, the headlines of these sort of multi-million pound tax bills are all very eye-catching and things like that. And yeah, there is certain things to be said. You know, say the Department for Work and Pensions, for example, is struggling to work out how to run the IR35 rules within or follow them within their organisation. You know, what hope does maybe a private sector organisation who's maybe not as well resourced or well versed in kind of legislative stuff?
Yeah.
Given similar changes were rolled out to the private sector earlier this year. But yeah, these stories are sort of interesting for a couple of other reasons as well. So as I mentioned, HMRC has this tool, and it's been absolutely savage since it was launched. By lots of different people. Search on Computer Weekly, we've written so many stories about the problems that have emerged with CESS, people getting the wrong results, it not following case law is a bit, employment case law and things like that. It's just loads of issues, and there's more to come on that as well. And people saying it's error prone, not fit for purpose. DWP use CESS to figure out how they should be taxing their contractors. So that's quite kind of like, okay, so they used HMRC's tool, but HMRC declared that they'd followed the rules incorrectly, or they'd implemented, they'd made historic inaccuracies with their set. So what's gone wrong here? Is it the fault of CEST? Is it the way it's been used? Or, what's gone on here? Like I say, the same changes were rolled out to the private sector earlier this year. And at the time, the government said, okay, we're going to, for the first year, but these reforms are bedding in, we're not, very light touch penalties. It's all about letting it bed in. You've got lots of difficulties going on in the economy anyway with COVID. Give you a year to get your act straight, basically. But then I think at the moment you're hearing that as a private sector organization, but then you're looking at things like this DWP fine thinking, oh, hold up, so we've got a year to get things in place and get things, follow all this correctly, but if we don't, that's what we could be on the receiving end of, in 12 months 18 months time. These stories are almost like warning shots, I think, to the private sector as well. So if you're a private sector organisation and you've been grappling with IR35, I think either it's going to, really convince people to, right, okay, we need to really clear up our processes, or it could have the opposite effect and make people think, we don't want to get accused of doing anything wrong. Let's just declare everyone inside IR35, or let's just stop using contractors. They're more trouble than they're worth. And just duck out of the whole debacle altogether. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, there's more, like I said, there's going to be more stories about public sector organisations getting big tax bills on the back of this. And inevitably, in the months to come, once this standstill period, if you like, on enforcement in the private sector ends, probably even more tax bills coming from that way too. So yeah, keep me busy.
So it turns out that implementing these reforms is quite difficult.
Yeah, apparently so. But it's hard to get any real detail on precisely what's happened. So like I say, the Home Office, they were told that, in the sort of summary of what happened there, it just said, it's been found to be careless with their implementation of it. So when I asked the Home Office, what does carelessness mean? It's like, okay, we're not saying. HMRC can't tell you because they can't disclose information to other people about your tax affairs. So if I said, I want to hear how much tax is Brian McKenna paying on the phone at HMRC, they wouldn't tell me. In the same way, in the same way, if I find out, say, hey, so what does carelessness mean in the case of the Home Office? So that's a tax, that's someone else's tax affairs. Get your nose out there. There is definitely a case for transparency here, because whatever mistakes these organisations have made, others will probably be making them too. So it should be a learning opportunity.
And with these, maybe I used the wrong word, but with these inverted commas fines, is it too simplistic to say they're just moving money around from department to department?
Well, effectively, yeah, because I think, so HMRC, they pay the money to the Treasury, and then the Treasury just, hey, at the end of each year, here's how much money each department's getting. So it all just, it's like a circle of money, I guess, moving around. Now, everyone's kind of watching it with interest, because I can't remember the figures off the top of my head, but HMRC put out some quite ambitious figures for how much money they thought they would recoup in unpaid tax through these reforms. And so I think, adding it up, okay, so they've got 87.9 million from this department. They've got however much it was, which I can't remember off the top of my head, for the Home Office. Yeah. And then, you know, whatever else they bring in, yeah, see if they do manage to hit their targets, as it were.
Yeah, just get the calculator out and add up all the numbers.
More of a spreadsheet person myself. Can't be doing with the calculators.
And so the implications for the private sector, I suppose, for a lot of our readers, that might be, if they're thinking, or just too simplistic, that, oh, well, if the government can't sort this out, what chance do we have?
I guess. I mean, if they do take that point of view, they've still got to do what they can to abide by the rules. Because, like I say, it's kind of a catch-22. If you just think, okay, well, if the government can't get it right, what hope do we have? Let's just, yeah, say HMRC can still come after you for, like I say, careless implementation, whatever that means. So I think you just have to just do your best, as with everything in life, and just hope it all works out. Mm.
Cool. So, but plenty more to come.
Yeah, I've got a few different things in the works. So obviously, keeping an eye on all this stuff. But comes back from the summer holidays, we're going to be probably nearing 6 months since the IR35 reforms came in. So we're going to be looking at sort of, you know, 6 months on in the private sector. What's going on? Like, you know, how's it going, guys? So yeah, do a few check-in articles on that as well. So yeah, just IR35 is just the gift that keeps on giving, really, editorially for me.
Yeah. Moving on to our annual celebration of women in tech and diversity. So Claire, are you busy at the minute?
Yeah, definitely busy. We just had our first judging session for the list of the top 50 most influential women in UK tech. The shortlist has been decided. The voting article's up. I'm getting together speakers for the diversity event in September, which is going to be online again this year. It's all going good.
Good stuff. And as you said earlier, we can start voting, or people can start voting now.
Yeah, absolutely. They can vote on the shortlist for who on the shortlist they think should be named the most influential woman in UK tech 2021. And then all of the voting from that sort of acts like one of the judges in the final judging session. So the votes are taken into account when we decide the winner and the list of the top 50 as well. And the order of the list of the top 50, if I should say.
And the Hall of Fame, some developments there.
Yeah, so it's the 10th year that we've done the list. And I think, so it was born in 2012. It's the 10th list. It was born in 2012 and it was the top 25 back then. And then more and more people got put forward. This year, for example, there were over 500 women on the long list. So this year we decided to add 10 women to the Hall of Fame as well. So the Hall of Fame is kind of like, as it sort of says, you know, like the clue is in the name, but it's people that have made a lifelong contribution to both the tech sector and the diversity and tech movement as well.
And there's about 24 or 25 of them now.
I haven't counted, but if 10 went on this year, then there are more women on the list.
Oh, very mathematically.
You don't need a spreadsheet for that kind of maths.
So is there, obviously with the event every year, it kind of has a theme. Are you allowed to tell us anything about the theme yet? Or is it under wraps and just like, you know, are we going to get an exclusive on the theme?
I can tell you about the theme if you'd like to know. I know.
Yeah. I really want to know.
Oh my God, it's so important. It's a bit of a, how do I put it? I'm going to babble about it because it's a bit conceptual. So we were thinking, you know, it's been 10 years since we started the list. So let's take a look on the last 10 years of the women in tech and diversity in tech movement. Then look at the fact that even though there's been progress, the pandemic has sort of shone a light on the fact that the people who that movement is trying to help have been disproportionately negatively impacted by the pandemic. Mm. So what can we do to make even more progress in the next 10 years?
Very good.
So the kind of COVID aspect.
Well, yeah, because if you look at, you know, the way that the pandemic has affected people, parents, especially women, have been negatively impacted by the pandemic. People who work in hospitality So people who work in hospitality have been massively negatively impacted, and a majority of people who work in sectors that have been negatively impacted seem to be women.
Yeah, there's been quite a few stats, haven't there, that out of all the job losses, the majority have, that have resulted from COVID, the vast majority have involved women rather than men across the board. So yeah,
so what can we do? Because even if there's progress, you know, how many steps back have we now taken because of that? And how do we stop that from happening again in the future? You know, like, it has to be the new normal rather than, you know, like, the second that cuts need to be made and something bad happens, that can't be, you know, like, the first thing to go.
Yeah,
we've discussed this a few times on the podcast, haven't we? So yeah, I really like the idea of you know, your conceptual idea of taking stock of that, you know, and bringing together all the kind of thinking and observation and the stats, like Caroline was saying. So is that an exclusive on the podcast that it's going to be that?
I don't know if it's been announced anywhere else yet. So let's say yes.
Yeah.
There you go. Introducing.
The inside line. You don't get it unless you listen to this podcast.
Well, you certainly don't get a babbly explanation about it unless you join the podcast. It might be written down somewhere, but.
Yeah. No, it's cool. It's cool.
I write it better than what I talk.
The Hall of Fame thing. I read the article, Claire, you did on that. It's really interesting to charting progress, for example, and Anne-Marie Emma Fiden. She was a rising star. Last year's winner, and now she's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. It's worth noting that the winners automatically get put into the Hall of Fame because they deserve it. But yeah, so she was originally a rising star, which are people that, you know, like, we've got our eye on, that seem to be in a position that they could definitely make the top 50 in future years.
Yeah.
And yeah, so she went from being a rising star to being a winner.
And I've also noticed that Carrie Ann Philbin.
Mm-hmm. She's been appearing on the top 50 for quite a while.
Yeah, okay.
And that she does a lot in terms of like STEM education.
I had a quick look before the podcast at her crash course in computer science on YouTube. She is fabulous. I mean, she's just obviously such a good teacher, communicator, very animated, very friendly. Very cool. Very cool.
it's cool the way, you know, like, that a lot of the people on the top 50 and in the Hall of Fame, they're very creative and they use, you know, like, all of the mediums available to them. There are a bunch of extremely hardworking people, you know, like, they're doing all of the jobs all of the time. You sort of think, how, I've said this before, but how do you have enough hours in the day to, you know, like, be doing all of these things?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And Sue Daly has swum the English Channel.
She did, yeah.
As well.
Fantastic.
I didn't know that. I've spoken to her a few times for Tech UK. Never knew.
Yeah. She wanted to do it and then she did it.
She went.
She went. Amazing achievement.
Now, I do like the fact that, you know, you have the Hall of Fame and then I guess that frees up space in the list for new people. And then we never run out of people. So obviously, hopefully we are, you know, things are changing. So that's all positive.
Yeah, it definitely, when you've got over 500 women on the long list, you start to sort of feel as if there's some change. And then also as if all of the people who are like, oh, where are all the women in tech? There aren't enough. I can't hire anyone. Like, that's bullshit, mate. Look at all of these women.
Yeah. Consult the list. Sir. Yeah. Because it would be a man saying that, wouldn't it?
So thanks for that, Claire. It's always a really exciting thing for us and building up to it and stuff and all the kind of workshops and so on that you had last year. Cool stuff. So from Claire on the culture of diversity and women in tech to the topic of company culture or cultures, which I wanted to have a little discussion about. And this is on the back of an interview I did with Chano Fernandez, who's the co-CEO of Workday. Now, Workday, they basically do HR and financial software in the cloud. So the software as a service company. Fairly new to me, oddly enough, because although I've been covering business applications for Computer Weekly for a while, the guy who really did HR software for a long time was Bill Goodwin. And Bill just does investigations now. So I've taken up the HR software mantle as well as the other ones. Little thing on Workday, they've got about 13,000 employees, founded by David Duffield and Anil Bhusre. David Duffield is very famous for having formed PeopleSoft back in the mid 80s, 87 in fact, which then got acquired, some would say aggressively, by Oracle in 2005, which is when he then went on with Anil Bhusre to found Workday. I mean, my interview wasn't with them, it was with Chano Fernandez, who is a bit unusual, and he described himself that way as being a bit of a rare beast, because he's the European CEO or co-CEO of an IT company. And as we know, IT companies, well, the industry is very dominated by America, by the US, and by California in particular. So it's very unusual to get a European as CEO of one of the kind of big brand name IT companies. He's been co-CEO for a year, joined Workday about 8 years ago, but he's an enterprise software veteran, so he's worked for SAP and Infor and so on, and had a spell at McKinsey as well. But the bulk of our conversation was about culture. Quite a good way into this, I think, for Workday is at the start of the pandemic, are quite well known for having given every single employee 2 weeks' wages. So everybody was given 15 days' salary to help them over the initial phase of the pandemic.
Is that like upfront or additional money?
Well, it was just extra money in their pay packets.
So it wasn't like you'd normally be paid on the last day of the month, but we're going to pay you twice this month.
Yeah, so it was a bonus.
Okay.
It was a bonus. And everyone in the company has shares, which vest over time. So, you know, Chano would say this, and the leaders of Workday would say this, that this gives everyone in the company a sense of ownership that it's their company. And they're very famous, the original founders, David Duffield and Anil Bhusre, for having interviewed the first 500 employees at Workday, which is quite a big thing, you know, for a CEO to interview the first 500 employees. It's almost unheard of, really, that, because they wanted to have an employees first culture from the very beginning. One thing he said was, all companies these days say we're employees first, but he said, you know, 10 years ago, it was all customers first, customers are what we care about. And yet he's got this, they've got this little sentence that you never see happy customers, but have unhappy employees. So having happy customers is a function of your employees being happy, they say. But he also admitted that, you know, because when you scale up and you go from like 500 to now, they've got over 13,000 employees Workday internationally. It's once you start scaling up, it's very difficult to keep that going. And that their culture did deteriorate. So they introduced in 2016 a program whereby all first-time to Workday managers, so not necessarily people who are new to management, but people who are new to Workday as managers, get taken over to California for 3 days of talking about culture. And he says that's really helped.
What does an employee first culture mean, though?
I think for them, it seems to mean things like giving them shares and giving them the bonus at the beginning of the pandemic, thinking about their welfare and things like that.
That's money, though.
That is money. That is money. And we are talking about culture here. But I'm going to come back to this idea.
Claire will make sure you do.
Yeah,
oh,
I will.
She's like a dog with a bone on.
I want to know. I want to know what that means.
And the other thing that it means, Claire and Caroline, is that they want employees to stay.
By giving them more money?
By giving them interesting work to do and creating a great environment for them, et cetera, et cetera. But it's less kind of banal than it might seem, I would say.
Was there any mention of things like flexible working or presenteeism when you have to come to the office?
Well, yeah.
What, presenteeism?
Yeah, they're massively into presenteeism. Chaining people to their desks.
Yeah.
Because they love it so much. And no, I think they've embraced hybrid and, you know, remote working, and they seem to have a good record on diversity. But just to circle back to this, they want employees to stay thing, because that's not necessarily the right answer. I mean, there are no right answers here. So in my piece, there's a link to an interview, not with Channel, but with Anil Busri, with Reid Hoffman, you know, the guy who founded LinkedIn. He's a really big figure in the Bay Area. He's a venture capitalist. So his concept is different. He says, well, what I want to do is to build, he's got this phrase, adaptive and creative companies. And he says that by definition, that means you have to employ adaptive and creative people. And adaptive and creative people are not going to stay. Whatever, they will do a quick tour of duty of one company after another. And the Bay Area is very much like that. You know, people move from company to company in San Francisco and Palo Alto and indeed London. That, you know, you do get a lot of job hopping and charming and stuff. So no right answer. But it's not, you know, it's not as kind of obvious, you know, the idea of wanting employees to stay on. Certainly there are Silicon Valley companies who don't want that. What do we think? I mean, do we want our companies to have a culture? Do we care? Do we just want a paycheck?
I think it depends what you mean by culture. You can get a particular feeling from a company. You know, like when you turn up, you go like, oh, okay, maybe an office has like a serious vibe about it or a quiet vibe. Maybe people go out of an evening, maybe they don't. Is there a culture of eating lunch at your desk? Do people go out for lunch? It's lots and lots of little things. It kind of boils down to whether you feel like you can turn up as yourself and do what you want to do without feeling like everybody's judging you for it.
And some of those things that Claire mentioned are sort of cultural things that come out because, you know, as a group of people, that's how people behave, and that sort of, you know, it's like a domino effect. Like if you see, oh, okay, there's a group of people there and they lunch at their desk and I've just joined this company, I guess that's what everyone does, and you sort of follow suit. So there's certain cultural aspects like that, but just like I say, through mirroring happen. And then you've got things where companies take like a hard line, like we're gonna have a fun culture, we're gonna have enforced fun every Thursday, you are involved, you know, like, okay, it creates a culture, but it's a forced one, and one that maybe is off-putting and not particularly inclusive to people who don't enjoy certain activities. So yeah, it's hard to sort of define, and also hard to know because everyone's different. Some people might respond really well to that kind of thing, some people might be completely put off it, some people might, you know, it's really hard. Yeah, actually, it's really hard to build a culture anyway, just one that is inclusive for everybody.
Yeah, because so for example, you could have that culture of like, oh yeah, we do a party every Wednesday, but then nobody goes, so you've got like one person who's, you know, like laid out snacks and drinks and everyone's still at the desk or whatever, and you're like, I've been sold something, but nobody here wants that. So like, what is the culture? Is it what I'm being told, or is it what's happening?
Yeah, it would have to be authentic to whatever the organization is.
There
are many cultures within companies. I mean, our culture as journalists at Computer Weekly is different to the way to tech target culture of the company that employs us.
Yeah, that's because our bit of the office was like a little cave. We were hidden away from everybody. And we reflect our environment. So maybe.
But the company culture does mean that we don't shut the door.
But then there are things, overarching things, that although our culture might be different, we are included in the wider bits that the company's up to. So it's not like a them and us. That would be a very bad culture to cultivate within a company. But it's kind of inclusive on each other's terms. Like, we're involved you if you want to be, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, Workday does seem to have a definite culture, and it's one of the places that people say it's a great place to work and stuff.
Do they say why, Brian?
Dig into the piece, Claire, and follow some links through to their fun pages about the culture that they have.
But is that just a picture of a fun time when everybody's sitting at their desk? Are they actors? True. Do they work there, Brian? Yeah. Do they?
I ain't saying it's true, Claire. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying this is what they're saying. It's very American, isn't it? Some of the things that I'm talking about here is, and it's quite specifically Californian as well.
I was going to say the first four letters of the word culture really do some heavy lifting in some of these conversations.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I'm just scared of Silicon Valley, but I'd end up in a cult. So I just keep all of them at arm's length. Just don't drink anything in any, but hey, we have snacks over here. And when I go on visits, so no, thank you.
Knock it out of their hand.
Yeah, don't know what's in that Kool-Aid, sir. Please.
Get it away from me. Yeah. I don't think I have enough energy to work at a Silicon Valley type company. When you think about the culture that it brings to mind for me when you say a Silicon Valley company is working endlessly, long hours, always having to be at the office, and like they bring everything that you need to the office, like food and gym and dry cleaning and an assistant to like write your mum a birthday card or whatever, because they don't want you to ever go home. That's what like springs to mind. So I don't know if it's like a, when I think of people in Silicon Valley saying like, oh yeah, but the culture of the organization, we've got all of this cool stuff, but to me it's like a veneer to make you join a company so that they can work you until you break. I'm very suspicious of people talking about culture.
I'm always really suspicious of companies. Oh, we're like family. In families you've got like, you have like sort of ties that make it very difficult for you to say no to people, or like there's loyalties that you can't just I don't want to do that, like, well, do that. Yeah, that always is a red flag for me, anyone who says their company is like a family. Like, no, you have a real family. You should do your own dry cleaning, like Claire alluded to, and get outside and go and see them sometime. But
I'd quite like to see my actual family.
But I think the thing always they talk about as well, we have like a day, like you hear companies who are always trying to promote how sort of forward thinking they are on culture. We always have these stand-up meetings every morning. We have a stand-up and everyone stands up like, no, sitting down, that's far more my culture, not standing up unnecessarily. No, sit down.
A laying down meeting.
Yeah. Much easier in the era of Zoom, actually. Not that I know that, but yeah.
What I'm getting out of this is the culture is important. It's important to join an organization that you're going to be comfortable with.
Yeah.
Sit down meetings. We're not family, and I will bring my own snacks and do my own laundry. Thank you. Yeah.
What happens when you bring two companies together which have two different cultures?
Battle to the death to see which one succeeds. I don't know why I've never been asked to run a company. I'd be very good at it.
I just don't know, Caroline. I think you find a happy medium eventually, depending on how integrated the higher ups want the companies to be, right?
Also, sometimes it's an opportunity to fix things that are wrong in either company's culture and learn from the other one. We have some serious suggestions.
Yeah. I think you got more than you bargained for with this conversation, Brian.
Not at all. That's exactly.
He wasn't expecting anything, really.
Well, I did wonder at the beginning whether I was just going to get a deadly silence, but no.
I've not been this animated for a long time.
Some engagement. We haven't even touched on dogs in the office.
I mean, it's not like we've ever not talked about that on a podcast before. I'm sure.
That's true. That's
but then it's not inclusive for the people who are allergic.
Yeah, when I found that out, I was like, oh God, that is so true, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people with dog phobias. We had a delivery driver to our house the other day. He was dog phobic. And yeah, that was really traumatic for all the people involved. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really kind of, you know, raised my awareness now about like, oh, it's cute for me to watch my dog run out of the house, but it's traumatic for other people. So.
Well, yeah, I told you about that thing that I went to with the, I think it was the post office at some kind of like learning technology seminar where they were saying that, you know, like dog attacks happen quite a lot. And one post person got attacked by a cat, but was too embarrassed to tell anyone, even though it was like quite a severe injury. But, you know, people have this sort of like stereotype that cats aren't as scary as dogs, but they're vicious if they want to be.
Yeah, don't like you. Always their authentic self, cats.
Yeah, so true.
Authenticity, very important, says Channel. And we did have a bit of a chat about differences between the US and Europe. And he did say that the whole Silicon Valley thing of like failing fast, starting again, he liked that. And that is an aspect of Silicon Valley culture, is that you can fail, they say. Reid Hoffman is actually quite a good example of that. Whereas in Europe, if you fail, you're finished.
Wow. Is that true?
Not looking at most of our politicians, I don't think so, no.
Oh, that's true. Yes, that's very true. But company-wise, well, maybe we're getting there. Maybe we're beginning to get to tolerating business failure a bit more, the way they are said to do in California. But yeah, I was gonna say something about money, wasn't I? Which was just basically, if you want to have a culture, it does cost. Like if you're gonna have a company that has lots of parties, you're going to have to pay for those and just accept that's what's going to impact our bottom line, which is part of the cost of doing business.
Is this you telling us what you want from a company culture is more cash? Throw some cash at it.
I was thinking, yeah, like if we had a company, would we want it to have a culture, and what would that culture be like?
Parties every day from the sound of it for you, Brian. That seems
parties important. For Brian. Sleeping a lot for me would be great. Please.
Probably a hybrid of the two, which brings to mind the other bit of the conversation, you know, sometimes you've got to bring different people together in cultures. So sleeping and parties, probably a happy medium for me.
Mm-hmm. If I could
slumber,
you know,
parties, there we go. We have slumber party.
That suits everybody.
Yeah, probably not HR though. Don't want any but like not sure we can, you know, enforce slumber parties.
Pizzas, branded tracksuit. Milkshakes, laying down somewhere comfy, bit of rave music on for Brian.
Yeah. I can see it all coming together quite nicely.
Yeah. And would we put our employees first?
No, last, bottom of the pile.
Yeah.
Not important. Too busy partying for us.
Pizza at the top.
Cool. Well, I'm sure lots of people would like to join our company on the basis of that. Provide a link to that, as to all the other stories we've discussed today, in the article that goes with the podcast. You can read that summary in computerweekly.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. So you can ask Alexa for us. But you do have to spell it out for her, because I tried that before this podcast. Don't forget the downtime upload. Don't just ask for Computer Weekly, because you won't get it.
Okay.
Sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week. And it just remains for me to say, as ever, thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you so much to Claire back on the podcast.
Anytime.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening to us and for getting all the way to the end. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.